The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory, America, bonjour, hi, Canada, I'm giving you a good morning. I'm inside the Beltway, and they're about to spend $1 trillion in infrastructure spending with a bipartisan vote in the Senate. And then Bernie Sanders introduced $3.5 trillion more. Now, the math in this adds up to Donald Trump spent $2 trillion, okay, $2.5 trillion, really, on COVID-related relief. That was necessary, PPP and other matters of absolute necessity given government-ordered shutdown. Once in a lifetime, and that's a real once-in-a-lifetime deal, because the COVID obliged the government to shut down parts of the economy. $2.5 trillion last year. President Biden shows up and he spends $1.5 trillion in new spending. COVID-related, allegedly. That's $4 trillion. Now they're spending another trillion on infrastructure. Now, that's not once-in-a-lifetime spending, although they like to call it that. That is stuff that should be happening on an ongoing basis, just like you do maintenance on your house. Fantastic Freddy was here yesterday to fix the air conditioning in Virginia at the house, and that's probably every 3 years, Freon's got to be tapped off and stuff like that. That's just ongoing maintenance. Building a house is a one-time expense. So this $1 trillion is allegedly building houses and roads for the first time, but a lot of it isn't. But that's $5 trillion total spent between Trump and Biden over 18 months. And now Bernie Sanders wants to spend $3.5 trillion. And the New York Times reports this morning that with Republicans who have branded the plan, the Sanders plan, a reckless tax and spending spree, all likely opposed, Dems will need to remain virtually united in both chambers, a difficult prospect given the moderates have already begun to raise concerns about the price tag. You think another four, we've all had almost at double digit inflation last month. Jerry Boyer reported to me yesterday we hit 10% month over month inflation. I'm not quite sure. He wasn't rounding up 0.5%, but by next month, we'll be in 10%. Anyone who's doing anything right now, Fantastic Freddy told me the Freon had gone up $50, 100% up from the last 2 years ago, topping off. Everywhere and everyone knows this who's doing anything. Commodities have gone way up. And Democrats are going to take the cork out of the bottle, and we're going to be off to the races, and it's a nightmare. Meanwhile, the Delta variant is ripping through the country, but it's not killing people at the pace that the alpha and beta variants did. 124,000 new cases yesterday, a total of 558 deaths. We mourn every death, of course. That's not to make light of the 553 people who died yesterday, according to the New York Times. Far down, it's a spike. Guess what? It's not impacting children. It is not impacting children. Yes, there are a tiny number of new children cases across the United States. And that's a terrible thing, but it's like all the other terrible illnesses that affect children and they break our heart, but there's no reason for parents to panic. And so in Dallas, children are, by order of the governor, supposed to be going to school maskless. And the Dallas superintendent ordered all students to wear masks in school buildings and on buses. There is no science for school masking. That's what I discussed with Dr. Fauci yesterday. He promised to go back and look at it. Everybody knows. Wall Street Journal story yesterday by the two doctors went everywhere in the world. Parents know. No need for kids to mask. And it screws them up. It hurts. It really hurts K through three. Here's former CDC director Robert Redfield. I think he wanted to be Robert Redford. Robert Redfield on Fox with Martha McCollum last night. Cut number two.
Yeah, I think it's really important you raise it. These policies should be grounded in data as opposed to opinion. I think your guest raises a very important part. There's been very few studies that really are compelling in that setting of the classroom. We did a number of studies when I was there just in fixed settings to recognize that if you aerosolize virus through a mask and then the recipient had a mask and these were all dummies in rooms that were ventilated to a different degree, you could have an impact on the amount of virus that went from one to another. But that's not to say in a real life scenario that that's efficacious in the classroom. One of the things that I think is really important in the classroom, for example, is how to identify the silent epidemic. This is why we've recommended in a number of jurisdictions are doing this, to do routine testing of all the students twice a week so they can find out who's asymptomatically infected and who isn't and get them out of the transmission cycle.
So I haven't done that. Oh, Martha's phone was on. That was funny. Martha's phone was on. No evidence, none. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster added to that point yesterday, cut 11.
For the government to mask children to have no choice to protect adults who do have a choice is the wrong thing to do, and we're not going to do it.
That's exactly what's happening.
We're not going to shut out.
Teachers' unions are protecting their members from mandatory vaccine. We need mandatory vaccination of adults. It's effective. It works. It's safe. The Pentagon announced they're going to mandate the COVID-19 vaccine for U.S. service members. That's good. They serve the country. They did so voluntarily. Anyone who works for the government anywhere can be ordered to get a vaccine. They should be. Now, the Wall Street Journal reports that vaccination status has Americans picking sides. People are fighting about that. That might be the case, but people pick sides over sports. People pick sides over disputes over child custody. People pick fights over who's going to take care of mom and dad. People pick fights all the time. Doesn't mean that one side is right just because they're fighting. They're not. There is no good argument against the vaccination. None. People may choose not to get vaccinated. Teachers may choose not to get vaccinated. You should not impose that cost on anyone except yourself. And if you're not vaccinated and you're invited to the party, you ought to be saying, well, do you want me to come? I'm not vaccinated. If they say, sure, great. The Delta variant is sending more children to the hospital. Are they sicker too? According to the New York Times. Yes, there are a few more children in children's hospitals across the United States. They don't know the severity of the illness. Good news. Of 600,000 Israelis who received the third dose, according to the Times of Israel, only 50 out of 600,000 reported side effects. Meanwhile, oil prices slid yesterday on worries that the Delta variant will crunch demand. And then we got the annual report from the IPCC, the UN Climate Alarm Council, and it's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And they said that nations have delayed curbing their fossil fuel emissions for so long that they can no longer stop global warming from intensifying over the next 30 years. Though there is a short window to prevent most harrowing future. What a surprise. They want government control. There is, however, no call. Don't take it seriously. They don't call for nuclear power. Never take anyone seriously who doesn't say we need a lot of nuclear power now. That's the only way you're going to get the kind of power this planet needs to be free and healthy and growing with cars moving around. When they start building nukes again, then you can take people serious. Climate change has consumed journalistic standards, Gerard Baker writes in the Wall Street Journal this morning. He bets he's right. Is this the end of summer as we've known it? The New York Times headline asked the other day, writes Baker, with characteristic hysteria. Parens, it's an old truth in journalism circles. When a newspaper headline asks a question, the answer is almost always no. Has this man found a cure for baldness? Are we all going to be vegans? Is this the start of a new era for the Jets? Ouch! Used to be the Browns were the punchline, now it's the Jets. The journal also asks, student loan forbearance forever? Because the Biden administration is saying, not yet, you just keep not paying that. I've told you they planned $3.5 trillion. Did I tell you the Taliban made sweeping new gains overnight? Kabul is now in a crisis. There's a construction supercycle underway, according to the Financial Times. You know what a supercycle means? As governments across the world surge spending, it means the price of everything goes up, from Freon to cement. Boris Johnson is making a big gamble on this, which I'll tell you about after the break. Biden's big gamble as well is that people will politically like the short-term benefits and ignore the inflation risk. And in Great Britain, almost half of every student received an A or A start as grade inflation reaches a record high. In the COVID year, they normally get about 25% of English students get A-levels, which allow them to go to the more colleges. 50%+ got them last year. And the education secretary said, well, that's kind of what we needed to do because it was COVID, you know, and everyone will feel bad if they didn't get an A-level, meaning that the A-levels mean nothing. I'll be right back, America. That's the rundown on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. David M. Drucker is in the house of the Washington Examiner. I want to talk to him about his article yesterday on my pal Robert C. O'Brien. But first, David, you got small kids. Or kids, I'm not sure they're small anymore.
Yeah.
What do you think about masking K through three? That's the argument I had with Dr. Fauci yesterday. I think it's nonsense, unsupported by science, with real costs. You're a parent. What do you think?
You've asked me. And I followed parts of that interview. I haven't read the whole transcript yet. Look, I'm just going to give you my opinion because I've had to deal with this because I have a 6-year old and I have a child going into the fourth grade. I guess out of, but I dealt with this last year, and that is. That if I can get my kids on campus full time for normal schooling on campus and including a field program that our school happens to have a lot of field trips, I'll live with the mask. I'm not making a scientific judgment here, but if it helps our school for, it makes people feel comfortable, if it helps for insurance reasons, if it helps for teachers, I'll do it and I'm not going to complain about it. What I don't like and what I didn't like was my children being away from campus for an extended period of time.
Well, of course I agree with that.
That is damaging.
I agree with that, but that everyone's going back to school. The schools know they will have a revolution if they don't go back to school. But I don't think you should be, I mean, if you have the opinion that masks are fine, that's okay. It's just that I've had three calls. People hate masks. They have kids with speech.
I hate masks.
No, but just stay focused on the kids. The cost of masking kids are enormous.
Right. The point I'm making here is not in either it's not a defense of the policy. It's just to say that there are things I care about more. And it's
that's what Fauci told me yesterday, too. And then I pressed him on it because it's not the question. Everybody agrees with that. The question is, do we put masks on K through three? And on that, they're all going back to school, David. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, they should all go back to school.
No, but on putting kids on masks on K through three, because there's no science.
I don't have a problem with it. I don't have a, I'm not saying there is science, and I'm not a big defender of the policy. If my school said they weren't required, I'd be thrilled. I just don't think it's damaging my children.
All right. That's
bother me.
That's okay. That's an opinion. That your children are not being damaged. You don't care. I think that is, by the way, the opinion of a lot of parents. But if people think their kids are suffering, they are going to be militant. And that's what's driving people. Well, let's go to O'Brien. You wrote the first piece about my buddy Robert O'Brien, last seen in California moderating the California recall debate with me and doing a fine job. I thought he'd be signed by NBC, CBS, or ABC this week, or Fox, because he did such a great job. But you think he's running for president? Not think. You picked up signs he may be running for president?
I think that he is interested in running for president. I don't think it's necessarily a slam dunk the way I think with some other people that I've covered and that I've written about extensively. I do think that Mr. O'Brien, Ambassador O'Brien, is hearing from at least some people, if not a number of people, that have encouraged him to run because they think he brings something important to the table from a foreign policy perspective and just from the perspective of having a pretty logical, conservative thought process. And he also has relationships in the Trump wing of the party as well as the traditional wing of the party. He came out of the traditional wing. He was probably the best national security advisor Trump had.
Easily.
He was able to navigate all of that stuff, and he was able to navigate a very mercurial president. And so I think some people see him as an interesting candidate, and he is now doing what all of the rest of them are doing. In order to lay the groundwork for a possible bid, he's focusing on helping Republicans running in 22. And as I reported, he's hosting headlining a fundraiser for J.D. Vance, the Ohio Senate candidate. And he's going to be traveling the country, helping other congressional candidates for the Republicans. So add him to the list.
I do, because I mentioned him in passing only because if they had a contested convention, there is a Mormon lane. And it involves Idaho, Wyoming, of course, Utah, Arizona, Guam, and American Samoa. Not real. And you got to look at California, too. There are places where LDS matters a whole bunch, when people elect delegates.
That's true. And look, somebody like O'Brien, and I'm just riffing here, but imagine that you have a sort of young, dynamic candidate, but without a lot of foreign policy experience, would happen to rise to the fore. Or even, I guess, an elderly, dynamic candidate who happens to rise to the fore, and they need a sort of button-down, experienced vice presidential running mate with a lot of foreign policy know-how. I mean, you know, Mr. O'Brien could fit in that regard. And one of the best ways to put yourself in contention to be picked as vice president is to run for president. Not always the case. Mr. Pence didn't have to run for president to be selected by Mr. Trump, but it often helps.
I thought it was a great piece because it's the first time I've seen someone other than me mention O'Brien. I've seen stories of his being in South Carolina. He told me, I asked him about that because I was working on the debate with him last week. And he's very good on TV, too. He did Margaret Brennan, Chuck Todd all the time. I asked him about it last week. He said, that was a vacation. That was a vacation. And I said, sure, Robert, like Tom Cotton firing machine guns in New Hampshire just because he happened to be in the northern part of the Granite State 2 weeks ago. Right. I think
it
Cotton
so
and Pompeo.
Happened.
Yeah. Just so happened. Have you ever been firing machine guns in New Hampshire, David?
No. I mean, and I was recently in New Hampshire following the governor up a mountain. Definitely not a vacation. I don't think anybody in politics vacations in New Hampshire. All due respect to the New Hampshire tourism industry. It's a beautiful state, but that's not why we go.
And by the way, is Sununu running for Senate?
He's very intrigued. I don't think he's decided, but he is definitely intrigued and mulling it over.
Gosh, I hope so. That's a pickup for the Republican. Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Kirkman Resveratrol Omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Dewitt. It's the 10th day of August, 2021. Virginia Beach School Board meets tonight to decide whether to put masks on children in schools. They should vote no. They had a bunch of parents turn out there last week, and Glenn Youngkin, who's running for governor, knows this, and everybody in the country knows this, but does Byron York know that this is a hot issue? Hello, Byron. Good morning.
Good morning, Hugh. How are you?
That transition was a little rough, but I've been talking about masking children in schools, which is really the stupidest thing that the CDC has done among many bad things this year. And I think it's actually driving people out of the Democratic Party and driving the recall of Gavin Newsom. What do you make of masks on kids in school?
Well, I was listening to your conversations, and you had some very good parents and others who called. And the one thing I thought was missing from this, I think during the worst of the pandemic, masks offered some measure of protection for adults, and it was debatable how much it was, but it offered some measure of protection. But they became something much more than that. Masks became much more than just a physical barrier that hopefully would stop some of the virus transmission. They became the most visible sort of virtue signaling. And certainly, as I, for example, traveling between Washington, D.C. and South Carolina, the mask culture, which is completely different, in Washington, D.C., in all public areas, everybody was wearing masks. In South Carolina, they weren't. Going to New Orleans a few months ago, most of it was completely open. I went to one restaurant on the outskirts of New Orleans, just completely mask-free. Everybody was kind of having a party. Then you go to a coffee shop in a progressive part of the city. Everybody's wearing their masks. It became a visible statement. And that, I think, is still part of this debate, and with parents wanting to make that statement through their youngest children as well.
Now, what's interesting, that is no doubt true, which is why I continually bring the debate back to the very specific question of K through three, because there are a bunch of concurrent debates about COVID. Do I get vaccinated? Do I get a booster shot? Can the government mandate the military? Can they mandate contract? There are like 1,000 COVID discussions. And I often say, I don't know. I often say, go get vaccinated. The overwhelming evidence is if you don't have an underlying medical condition that forbids it, go get vaccinated. But the overwhelming evidence of the downside of masks on K-3 is with this one area where the CDC's gone off the rails. And you know, Fauci admitted it to me yesterday. And I don't give Dr. Fauci a Rand Paul hard time, but I do press him on stuff. And he admitted, well, we got to look at that again. Maybe that's a short term thing because I hear what you're saying. And he understands these doctors in The Wall Street Journal are big, big names in his world, came out and said, this is crazy. And the UK came out and said, we're not masking kids. I think as a political issue, it's discreet and ought to be separated from the rest of the discussion, because here there is no science. There is no argument at all. But the virtue signaling is having real world consequences, Byron. That's why I carve it off.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, especially on the political left, view children as kind of the next frontier in the COVID battle. Because, you know, the vaccines are not approved for use for children 12 and under. A lot of them are pushing for that, even though it's just not risk. There's not enough risk there to warrant doing this. So masks are the same way. And focusing on K through K-3, the youngest, I mean, the very youngest, I think is a smart thing to do. But it's clearly, going back to the virtue signaling, it's one of the new areas in this battle, because I would say, with the exception of people with autoimmune disorders, some very specific conditions, I think that there's a consensus about vaccinations. And of course, what happens is when people get involved in a cause and they prevail, they want to take it farther.
This is very wise.
Mother is children.
This is a very wise summation. There's a culture war in the United States. A battle, a front in that culture war is COVID. And a battle on that front is whether children's ought to mask. And the most intense battle on that front is whether K-3 ought to mask at school. And that's how you ought to think about COVID. And we've identified a front where the anti-masking people, I tried to explain this to Fauci, you're sacrificing credibilities. You're pouring troops and resources and credibility into a battle you cannot win because of, I point to Jeff in Ohio, the lawyer who's married to a lawyer with two little boys, one who's, you know, probably just a touch on the spectrum, very smart and needs the mask, and one who's got a speech disorder and he hates masks. It's just not something where, but the culture wars consume everything. It's just too damn bad. Let me ask you about consuming everything. Let's talk about the Sanders budget. Another $3.5 trillion, Byron. Are they going to get 51 votes for this? Because inflation is going to go from near double digits to roaring if they pass this thing.
You know, I think after an amendment process, they're determined to do it. And it just seems crazy. But after an amendment process, I think they view this as their chance. Now, it's bizarre when they have just 220 votes in the House. I mean, they can only lose a handful, literally a handful of votes. And the Senate is tied 50-50. I mean, I'm just a broken record talking about the Democrats do not actually control a majority of seats in the Senate. The vice president constitutionally is forbidden from voting unless there's a tie. So they got to get their 50. They got to get their 50 going. They view it, I think, this is emotionally, this is a leftover from the Trump years where they felt so aggrieved and so angry that they wanted to just pass this, enact their entire agenda, this entire agenda that they felt was frustrated. They felt would have happened under Hillary Clinton, but was frustrated under Donald Trump. So they want to just do this. And the fact that they don't even control a majority of seats in the Senate is not, they feel, a reason to not do it.
Yeah, but Byron, they will get wiped out if they do things like amnesty when reconciliation, if they do things like eliminate stepped up bases, which will crush millions of Americans at the time of the death of the second spouse. Family businesses will be sold, farms. It's just crazy what they're proposing to do politically.
On the amnesty thing, I think, which is use reconciliation to pass a measure that would legalize some large portion, if not all, of the people who are in the United States illegally. The number usually is 12 million, but who knows what it really is. But I think on amnesty, that is real signaling. That's a messaging portion of the bill, because I believe they think that the Senate parliamentarian will tell them that they cannot use reconciliation to do it, but then they can go to their groups, their activist groups, and say, well, we tried. We gave it our best. Because the President of the United States himself has said he wants to throw amnesty in this enormous spending bill and pass it through reconciliation, which leads me to an idea. Do you think Republicans should press for tightening the filibuster, for filibuster reform on the side of tightening the filibuster, under making it clear that you cannot use reconciliation to do any BS thing you want to do?
Yes, because, by the way, I'm not so sure the parliamentarian will say no. It was reconciliation that repealed the tax on Obamacare. Tom Cotton killed the Obamacare tax via reconciliation. If they add a tax, if they just make revenue from amnesty, if they say $50 and we'll forgive your sins of breaking the law on entry, that makes it a revenue bill. I think they'll get it in. But I think the bigger they might, the House, I mean, they're going to get wiped out. They're going to lose 30 seats in the House minimum. And a lot of congressmen are going to lose their jobs if they vote for this. But if they do away with stepped up bases, Byron, and John Thune started to write about this as farmers and small foresters, it's everybody who owns a house in any city. It's a devastating deal. And if they do that, that's clearly under the reconciliation rules. That's a political, throwing themselves on a political hand grenade for the benefit of like almost no money. What's wrong with these political people in the Democratic Party?
Well, that's why I think you have to view this in terms of emotion as opposed to reason. First of all, I mean, politicians have done suicidal things in the past. I mean, they were in 2010, they were told that if they pushed Obamacare through, they would lose a ton of seats, and they lost, 63 seats in the House in 2010? Yep. So they sacrificed their jobs for it. They can do it again.
63 seats, my gosh. I'll be right back, America. After redistricting, that's a permanent majority for a decade. Stay tuned.
I love a stands on golden sand and watches the ships that go sailing somewhere.
Welcome back, America. That music means after a couple of weeks away, three, in fact, Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, former head of Southern Command, former Allied chief, supreme commander of everything, the NATO head. Also now chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation. Admiral Stav, how are you?
Doing well. I hope you are back. You look tanned, rested, and refreshed.
Well, I spent 2 weeks with grandkids under the age of 9, one of whom is 2, and so I tell people I had to come back to work to get some rest.
No, I have 4 under the age of 5. So I get it.
Wait, do you and Mrs. Admiral Stav ever take them on your own like we did?
We do, but, in limited doses, 48-hour limit. It's like Ben Franklin said about fish and visitors after 2 days.
We had a 72-hour pass because they'd been in COVID lockdown in England for a year. And those 72 hours were blissful for them. But my gosh, the fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I really did have to come back to work to get some rest. Admiral, I want to ask you about, are you a Jaguars fan? You're down in Florida most of the time. Are you a Jacksonville Jaguars fan?
I live in and around the beaches of Jacksonville, and I follow the Jaguars. But like everybody else, you become a total fan of the team you followed when you were 13 years old. So when I was 13, I was going to Quantico High School outside of Washington, D.C. So I'm a fan of the Washington Football Club, which I like to think of as my proposed name is the Fighting Admirals.
By the way, I love that name, and I knew that, but now the Jaguars have become my second team. I'm wearing my Browns gear because the Browns are the only team actually in the NFL, but if you're going to have a second team, my team is the Jaguars because of Urban Meyer. And yeah, I got to get you to meet Coach Meyer, who listens to the program often. He's already at work by now. It's 7:30 on the East Coast, and so he might already be at work. But the reason is you'd love Coach Meyer. He's very, very smart guy. But he had a quote yesterday, and I'd like to ask you the applicability of this quote to the U.S. Navy. He was asked by the NFL Network, do you have a four-year plan for winning? Because you got Trevor Lawrence, a new quarterback, and, I mean, the worst team in the league. He has lots of draft choices. And Urban Meyer replied, we don't have a four-year plan. We have a one-year plan. What is the relevance of that kind of thinking to the U.S. Navy, Admiral?
I think when you're in desperate straits, as the Jaguars are, because, as you say, statistically, they're the worst team in the league. They finish at the bottom. That's why they're getting all these draft picks. And when you're at the absolute ground zero, you have only one thing you can do, and that is to fight. And I'll quote a very ancient strategist. That's Sun Tzu, the great Asian strategist. And he's well known for cleverness and finding your way around the corner and tricking your opponents and thinking about the long game. But Sun Tzu also said, Hugh, when on death ground, fight. And I think that's where Coach Meyer is coming from. The team is not exactly on death ground. We have a great owner, Shad Khan, who supports the team. The city really supports the team. Getting the coach is huge. Getting the draft picks is huge. Not death ground, but pretty close. We got to perform immediately. And I suspect that Coach Meyer is channeling that ancient Sun Tzu, when on death ground, fight. Once you get through death ground, then you have the luxury of the long-term thinking. I'd say for the U.S. Navy, it's a bit of both. We got to be prepared to fight tonight on the South China Sea, as the saying goes. But we also have to play the long game in our acquisitions, our strategic thinking, where we send our ships, how we structure it, the kind of training we do. There's both a short and a long game that has to occur at the same time.
Is the United States Navy ready to successfully fight in the South China Sea tonight, Admiral?
I think it would be a close fight. But if you ask me as an admiral, would I rather take the turn or hold the cards of the U.S. Navy versus the People's Liberation Army Navy? I'm going to hold on to the U.S. Navy card because it's not just the Navy, because we, the United States, would bring massive long-range air from bases all around the region. We have domination in space. We have still an edge in cyber, in addition to having highly capable ships, deeply experienced. Having said all that, it would be a tough fight. We would lose ships. We would lose sailors. In fact, in the book over my right shoulder here, as you know, 2034, I'd be more worried about which hand of cards to grab. Because the Chinese are closing that gap. They're moving quickly. So short answer, yes, I believe the U.S. Navy can still prevail if we had to fight tonight, but it's getting closer and closer.
Admiral, 2034 has continued to sell and sell and sell for the same reason Tom Clancy's book sold and sold and sold. It's a strategist's approach to fiction, and I think it's very educational for people, and congratulations on a bestseller. By the way, how goes the sequel? Are you done yet? I mean, you've had a couple of weeks.
We're about halfway done. And it's set in 2054. And instead of China as the centerpiece, in 2054, it's artificial intelligence, as you would expect by mid-century.
I'm looking forward to that. Now, back to the Navy. They love 30-year plans, but they fought a war game during my vacation. I don't know what you were doing the last 2 weeks. I read about it. They lost the United States lost the war game in three moves. And it was, and they put the results out there so people would understand we lost the war game. Mm-hmm. You're not shocked by that, but do you think the public understands that while you say we will prevail, the losses would be high and the possibility of losing is real?
I'm not shocked, having participated in too many war games to even begin to count over the years. You win many of them. You lose quite a few of them. If you don't lose some of them, you're not doing it right. You know, this is not like an election in North Korea. this is something you want to be competitive. You want to see how it's really going to play out. And so, no, I'm not shocked. And as I just said, the Chinese are close in a lot of technologies. And plus, Hugh, you have to remember the South China Sea is home court advantage for them. They can concentrate all their forces there right from the beginning. If they come in with the element of surprise, I wouldn't be surprised to see the U.S. take a bloody nose or two. But over time, it's like World War II, over time, that industrial size capability kicks in. I think we would still prevail. But no, I was not surprised. And I think plaudits to the U.S. Navy for conducting a war game and for putting it out there, because that needs to be part of the conversation, too. This is not a slam dunk.
Now, I got a fly boy in the family who tells me I make a civilian mistake all the time. I'm reminded of General Mattis's chief of staff, Colonel Lethien, once told me civilians never think of second and third order consequences of war. He was right. And so I listened to my fly boy. I always overestimate the Chinese capability because they are a first generation carrier Navy and we are a fifth or sixth generation carrier Navy. And you learn stuff and that stuff matters. I just hope it matters enough, Admiral, and that the hypersonics don't offset that advantage. That's my civilian worry, is that those wonderful, magnificent machines that you have commanded as the flotilla commander, et cetera, that they don't all sink in the first wave of hypersonic missiles.
It is certainly a risky part of the scenario and was certainly, I am certain, part of the war game. On the other hand, once the first volleys go, there is a moment when the U.S. can respond. And again, we're not just relying on those beautiful 100,000 tons, 7 acres of U.S. sovereign soil at sea. They can move 1,000 miles a day. They've got a lot of protection around them. They're a tough ship to kill, even for a hypersonic. But they're not out there alone and unafraid. Again, long-range air coming in from a plethora of bases around the region. Behind that island chain, you're going to see our Marines, our Special Forces, our SEALs, our Green Berets, our Recon Marines moving around those artificial islands, going after those bases. We are going to find ways to shoot down some of the hypersonics. Others we will destroy before they are even launched. It's a complicated game of war game, but boy, it's not a game in real life. And yes, there will be losses and probably a carrier or two, but we have, 10 highly capable nuclear powered 100,000 ton carriers and another dozen or so large deck amphibs. That's a lot of firepower coming off the sea. That's before the Air Force kicks in, before our long-range cruise missiles kick in. We got a lot of capability to put at play as well.
I hope that the scenario I've been reading about where they also take out whatever carriers around, but at Tsugi, Okinawa, and Guam does not come to pass. I want to play for you, Admiral, an exchange between former National Security Advisor O'Brien and candidate for California Governor Doug Ossie that occurred at the debate I moderated last week. Let's roll that tape, Dwayne.
Thank you, Christine. According to FBI Director Christopher Wray, the Chinese Communist Party has taken trillions of dollars in U.S. intellectual property and is currently influencing American policy through donations to universities through front organizations like the Confucius Institutes. Governor DeSantis in Florida just signed legislation to stop this conduct in Florida. Congressman Ossie, what do we do to protect the UC system and the Cal State system, the gems of our educational program in California? It's what's made our state so great, so competitive. It's why so many innovators live here and come here to study. How do we protect those universities from IP theft and malign activity?
This is actually one of the most interesting questions that our country faces right now. It's not the UC thing I'll get to. CCP, as you know, is engaged in a systematic effort to steal our IP. It's been going on for at least 30 years. They started in agriculture. They've taken our tree technology, our livestock technology, our crop technology, and they've taken it to China, and they've tried to implement it. Right? Henry Kissinger wrote a book in 2011 called On China. It's about this thick, small print, but enlightening. I commend it to you to read if you want to know what the Chinese are up to. terms of the UC and CSU system, in terms of protecting the ability to continue with the IP, we need to have a very, very strong standard for who ends up owning the IP that comes out. I'm not sure that's a state or a federal issue. I would prefer it be a federal thing for all universities across the country, but we can do it here if we have to, and I would support it. We are at war with China. We're not shooting bullets yet, but we are at war with China. You need
What do you make of that, Admiral Stav?
Well, it brings us back to the conversation we had a moment ago, which is cyber and cybersecurity. That's another enormous part of any conflict, God forbid, between the United States and China. And I think Robert O'Brien, for whom I have a lot of regard, is correct to say we're already in a shadow war in this cyber zone. And in terms of militaries, we still, again, have an edge, not as significant as I would like, but that'll be a significant part of the conflict when and if it comes with China. By the way, before we leave entirely the military zone, I'll say the thing we haven't touched on that's utterly important, crucial perhaps, is submarines. Here, the United States has a profound advantage in our nuclear attack submarines, both acoustically, weapons delivery, experience unmatched. They would be a very significant force. You know, we used to talk about infantry, the queen of the battlefield, queen in the chess term, that can go anywhere.
Thank you for listening. Make sure you come back and check out all the other podcasts on the Salem Podcast Network. And remember to thank our sponsors, AndrewandTodd.com. If you believe in long-form interviews like I do, then do your real estate transactions with Andrew Del Rey and Todd Avakian. I've known both men for a long time. AndrewandTodd.com. Go there, answer a couple of questions. They'll tell you what's best to do with your house, or call them at 888-888-1172.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.